Okay, before I introduce the speaker, actually, I'm going to let Sean come up and introduce the speaker because he was Sean's roommate. But Dr. Fishman and Sam helped me round this gentleman up, and I've heard a lot of good stuff about him. I'm excited to hear his story. I don't think that I've heard anybody since I've been in the alumni tell me that they were more powerful than Sam and Dr. Fishman. So, and he did. So I'm excited to hear his story. So Sean, you want to come up and introduce him?
Hi, everybody. My name is Sean. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Sean. How y'all doing? I just love doing that. I'm sorry. What an honor this is tonight. I walked in here, and when I left treatment, it was August 13th, 1999. And since then, there have only been myself and two others that I see. And the others, I just never knew what happened to them. And I walked in tonight, and 4 years later, there's Pat and sitting there. It's like, oh, just wonderful. He was my roommate. I haven't experienced him sober, but when we were roommates, though, we were he was there before me, and I don't know, we had Richard Morgan, and we would go into class, and it had the, do you remember the Samsonite commercials where the gorilla gets on top of the luggage and just beats the, well, he would do that to the Kleenex, and you know, the Kleenex box, he'd just throw it on the ground and just stomp on that. And the other thing Patrick used to do was, it was in July, and he would have the air conditioning on, you know, minus 20, and and with his strong arms, we couldn't, you know, my roommate and I, we would just try to pry that thing at least up to, you know, 10, and we couldn't do it, and he would just sit there, laugh, read his big book, and just, you couldn't, in one hand, and we couldn't pry that open. Well, he was the first one of the three of us to leave, and we came back, my other roommate, Mike, and I came back from Richard's group, and he had the room on about 90. And 90 degrees, and he had it on so hot that, you know, and he was long gone, and 90 degrees, and you know, they had to replace that twice after that same week, but anyway, it was just, if you stick around here long enough, you'll be surprised, you'll be really amazed. When I walked in here and I saw Patrick, I couldn't believe it. I just, because I've wondered for the last 4 years, you know, I think of him often, and he has a very, very good heart, and I love this guy to death. So, Patrick.
Thank you. It's my sister back there. I'm glad you made it. Everybody, my sister's name is Kathy. It's embarrassing. Appreciate that. Waffle House? Scattered, smothered, and covered. Do some damage with that, huh? My name's Patrick. I'm an alcoholic, drug addict, extraordinaire. Yeah. Like Sean says, I was in his room, and we had a roommate that was from a family of, I don't know, a billionaire family, and they flew him in here on a private jet, and he had to be dealt with. Reggie wasn't gonna help him, you know. I expected when I came in, I thought, you know, there's gonna be 20 people here. I didn't know it was gonna be all this. I live in a small town with a couple red lights south here. And, you know, our meetings are real small and few and far between. But to tell you a little bit about myself and what's happened with me then and now, I was born here in Atlanta. in Stone Mountain, and we lived here till I was 12 years old. I'm not going to get into a lot of the childhood stuff because, you know, I grew up in the, I guess it was kind of a Leave It to Beaver kind of family. You know, we had an older brother, older sister, and mom and dad, and my dad was a successful businessman, and we lived in a, I guess, middle-class neighborhood or whatever, and I had a great childhood, and I got picked on real hard by my older brother and his friends, and I think the first time I met with Dr. Fishman, is he here, by the way, my lower power, Dr. Fishman? What about Sam? Sam here? All right. Well, Dr. Fishman asked me about my childhood, and I said, well, one time my brother and them, they tied me up naked, took my clothes off of me, tied me up, bound me with my own underwear, put me out on the front curb by the driveway, and poured Aunt Jemima syrup all over me. And when the cars had come by, they'd flick the floodlights on and off so people could see me. You're laying there. You know? Well. He looked at me and he says, Patrick, that's abuse. I didn't think it was. I thought it was his older brother doing that kind of stuff, you know. But I had a good childhood. You know, when I look back on it, I think that I had a great childhood. We moved to West Point, Georgia when I was about 12 years old. And my father went into business with a longtime friend of his who owned another insurance company, and they went into a partnership, and they sent me to a private school. I was going to a public school, and sent me to a private school, and they told me, my parents, I had failed the sixth grade over here at this school. But since I was going to this private school, they're going to let me go ahead to the seventh grade. So they let me go to the private school and go into the seventh grade. And I failed the seventh grade, so they held me back. These kids are diagramming sentences and stuff. When I got there, I'd never seen that. Yeah. But anyway. I started in junior high and going into high school, I got real involved in athletics, and that was something I was good at. You know, I was, I won the state heavyweight wrestling championship 3 years in a row in high school. I was undefeated in 3 years, and you know, I was good at that, and that made me feel good because I felt like I was somebody. You know, I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to be famous. You know, I wanted to be, when I got out of my limousine, you know, I wanted people coming over there and, you know, wanting to know me and stuff. And I wasn't an arrogant person, I don't think. I don't think I was ever arrogant, A brat. She says I was a brat. But I wanted to feel like I was important. And when I look back on that now, I realize that that was one of the things in my life that may have been one of the reasons I drank the way I did when I started drinking. I first took a drink. Well, you know, really the first time I got drunk, I was... I don't know, maybe 10 years old, and we were down in Jekyll Island on a family vacation. I got drunk with some older kids on the beach, and they came and found me and took me in. First time I'd ever let her take my clothes off in a swimming pool, you know, trying to sober me up, but they took me back to my parents. But during high school, I didn't drink a whole lot. I drank like a lot of the high school kids did. We'd go out and on the weekend or something and drink, and I didn't mess with any drugs. Even though my sister and them were smoking a little dope, you know, I didn't I didn't go out there. No. Yeah, that's back in 70, you know. But I went to, I wasn't drinking that much. But I noticed a couple times when I did go out where I was, my dad was a very controlling man. You know, one time in an AA meeting, I was giving my story, and I said, you know, a lot of people get up here and they say, well, you know, I was from a poor family. We didn't have nothing and that kind of thing. And that's okay. You know, nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, and I said, you know, I was from a wealthy family, and it had a lot to do with the way I felt about things. And some guy came up to me in a meeting after, said, you don't need to tell folks that. I said, you know, that's the lifestyle I was from. My dad and his partners, they started what used to be PowerTel. It was now T-Mobile, I think, and Mindspring Internet. They were involved in some pretty heavy-duty things. And I used to sit in there and listen to them talk around the kitchen table before they started all this stuff and listen to them. I think, you know, I want to be like that, you know. But my dad was from the old school. You know, he'd come home and put on the same pair of old dirty pants every day. He wasn't one of these, you know, we always wanted a BMW or something. He wouldn't ever buy us a BMW, you know. But not that he couldn't have afforded it. That's the thing, you know. But, you know, he wasn't like that, you know. He was a simple guy. I got used to a certain lifestyle, and I wanted to be like that for the rest of my life. And my dad was as kind and giving, give you the shirt off his back as you person you would know. My mom was a very committed Christian woman. You know, I accepted Christ in my life when I was 12 years old, and have had him with me even through those years I was drinking and drugging. And it made me very miserable because, you know, he was there tugging at me and the devil was tugging at me over here. But my dad, you know, he wanted things a certain way, and without even having to say things or use the words, I guess, he was just created this tension, you know. Ended up in high school. I was successful in athletics. I played on a couple of state championship football teams and got a full athletic scholarship to play in college, and went to college. That's when it really started, you know, because, you know, that's when I found out that, you know, I was somebody, because it took me about a year to create that person that I wanted to be, but I knew I could create it. I just had to get above these other guys, you know. I had to fight my way and earn a starting position, and then I would be somebody, you know. I was lost all those years. I look back on it now, and I was just a lost. I had no idea or clue to what reality was all about. I was living in a dreamland, you know. I didn't have, you know, but I was on a full scholarship, and my dad would put money in my checking account, so all I had to do was go out and spend money, you know. And, you know, when I started doing the cocaine and stuff and that money started disappearing real quick, he'd say, where'd that money go? I'd say, well, Dad, you know, dating gets expensive. He believed it, you know. You know. As I was in college, we reached the pinnacle and played on two national championship teams. And, you know, the media was all in it. And, you know, I was somebody, you know. I was important, you know. And like I said, I don't think I was going around and trying to be above people. I just wanted that feeling, you know. I was this kind of person that was a leader among my peers socially, not academically. Not academically. because I failed out of college 3 times while I was in college, and every time the administration got me back in school. See, I never had to leave because I was somebody, you know. And they don't think that kind of stuff goes on, and it does, you know. And I didn't go to class. Yeah, I went sometimes, and, I failed because of it. But they'd get me back in school and keep me eligible. And you know what? I wasn't a bad person. But I wasn't living the right life. And I knew I wasn't because I knew spiritually where God wanted me to be, and I wasn't doing that. I knew exactly where He wanted me to be, and I wasn't doing that. I was living the life of this world out here and doing the things that gave me that temporary pleasure that was, none of it was long lasting. It was all temporary. Anyway, but going into my senior year, I got set up in a drug bust. They had a sting operation going on. And I, by the way, during this time, I'm drinking a lot and, snorting a lot of cocaine and taking ecstasy and everything else they're throwing in there, you know. So, a guy that was playing ball with me, who had gotten arrested for burglary or something, he actually set me up. I never sold any drugs, but he got me just to hand it from the dealer to him. And the guy was a GBI agent, and they arrested me. So I told you I always wanted to be famous. Well, you know, a month later, there's my picture, you know, tackling Tim Lester, who, you know, Sports Illustrated, big old, you know, picture in there. And, you know, everybody else, and they were calling my parents' house and stuff, and everybody thought that was bad, and I acted like that was bad around people. You know, I said, this is terrible, you know. But inside, I was going, this is cool, you know. I'm in Sports Illustrated, Jack, you know what I'm saying? And all the newspapers, I was on the front page of the Atlanta Sports page, and good picture. Yeah. And I liked that. I did. I liked that. And because even though in my mind, I felt like things were dwindling on me and I was losing what had brought me there, that gave me that little bit of, hey, well, you know, that'll stay with me a little while, you know, whatever. But so anyway, they kicked me out of school. And I was supposed to do an internship with the Ritz-Carlton Hotel down in Amelia Island, Florida. They had just opened a brand new one. And my dad was good friends with the guy that owned the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, and he had to call him personally to tell him what had happened. He said, well, let him come down here and work anyway, you know, get him away from it. So that's what I did. I went down there. You know, that scared me when I got arrested, because I'd never been in that kind of trouble before. I'd been in some bar fights and stuff like that, and been in some little misdemeanor things. And So I lived down there a few months, and I came home, and I tried to find a job, and I wanted to, you know, I started drinking again after about 2 weeks, after the fear got off of me. And I got a job with a company called Intercell, which later became PowerTel. If any of y'all familiar with what PowerTel was, and this all happened down in West Point, Georgia, just a little town there. And you know, I'm in here, and all these guys are, you know, I don't know what's going on, and they're, you know, I feel like, man, these people, they think they're better than me, and you know, I'm on the low end of this thing, and I'm just a peon in here, you know. And it's my own fault, of course, because, you know, I never did anything to warrant having anything more than that, you know. So I said, this ain't me, you know. I said, I play football. That's what I do. That's what I'm going to do. And so I didn't. You know, I had a fear. I knew my dad was going to say, don't waste your time. You know, don't. I didn't want to go through all that, but I made up my mind. I couldn't take it. I said, I'm going to go somewhere and play. So I quit drinking a little bit, got back in shape, and got a tryout with the Philadelphia Eagles, and I went up there and played during preseason, got cut in the last week, and came home, but, you know, out of the free agents the first week there, I started until the older guys came in, and, you know, when I thought, you know, I'd done really good. I knew in my heart I could play. I'd proved it, you know. But when I came home, you know, instead of working on trying to – see, I was afraid of failure, you know. And I couldn't stand thinking that if I tried out again and didn't make it, that people were going to say he wasn't no good, he shouldn't have been trying out, you know. I didn't want that, you know. I was afraid – you know, I was the kind of guy that, like I was saying earlier, I was, you know, a leader among my peers socially. You know, I was always in, had a lot of friends. But, you know, I was the kind of guy, before we'd go out or something, you know, I might change my shirt 5 times, you know. I was so afraid of what people thought of me, you know, and how I looked. But I didn't act like it, and nobody else knew it. And if they did, you know, I didn't know they knew it. You know, I think that's one of the big reasons I drank so much. Don't get me wrong. I've had a lot of time to look back and think, you know, I think I was born an alcoholic. It just didn't come about until later in life. But I look back at my way of thinking and just, you know, I just feel like I was different in some respect, you know. However, that doesn't really matter. You know, what matters is what we're doing today. But... so anyway, that was just the beginning of my problems. Actually, I came and I set up shop at home and lived with my parents a little while. I actually moved to Atlanta here and started working for my sister's husband, who owned a business here. And, you know, was, what happened was I got a DUI and I was still on probation from that thing that happened in college. And they said, well, they're going to come take you to jail unless you go to a rehab, you know. I didn't know what a rehab was, you know. I sure didn't need it, you know. But I agreed to it because I didn't want to go to jail, so I went over there to Mar. And we sat around the circles, and I looked at everybody, and I said, man, these folks are messed up. They messed up. But... and they were. The man, so was I. The man gave me a test, you know, all this written test, see if I was an alcoholic. I said, you know, I got this. I was looking at these questions, answering it truthfully. I said, you know, if he asked me if I drank 15 beers, I'm going to say yes, because so do every other millions of folks, you know. So I answered, I said, there ain't no way I'm an alcoholic. I answered the test. He came back and said, you got a serious problem. I said, no, I don't. You know, I said, that test, you know, you do that to everybody. Don't give me that junk. You know, I wasn't going to play mind games with people. I didn't make good grades in school, but I could figure folks out pretty good, I thought, you know. But, and I wasn't one of these that was going to get caught up in some little, you know, bullshit mind game or something, you know, so... Anyway, I went there and got out of there and stayed sober for a year. But I wasn't staying sober because I didn't go to one AA meeting. I was staying sober because I had made a decision to live my life for the Lord, which I had wanted to do and I knew I should be doing. And that wore off and I quit doing the things I was supposed to be doing. I started drinking again. And a lot of different things happened over the years. You know, before I came to Ridgeview, you know, I ended up, you know, leaving her husband's job because he was going to fire me anyway. Because, you know, they would come looking for me at my apartment. But, see, I'd stay out all night and I'd get so drunk I couldn't get up. And, you know, I'd be devastated, you know, one. Because, see, I could drink so much And I never got sick, you know. I never threw up, you know. Toward the end there, you know, it wasn't nothing for me to drink a whole liter of Jack Daniels by myself at night, you know. I just have these horrendous hangovers, you know. And, you know, it paralyzed me. You know, I never got the shakes and all that kind of stuff, and where people say they needed to drink the next morning and stuff. I felt so sick I couldn't drink, you know. I was watching this situation on the news the other night with this guy who was attacked by the cops, and the police beat him and he died afterwards. Well, I was in the same situation one time, and I attacked some small town Alabama cops. They woke me up. I was in the passenger seat of my own car, passed out. A friend of mine was driving us home from a party. About 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, when everybody here knows this. I mean, you know, when you get real drunk to the point you pass out, when somebody wakes you up before you're supposed to, man, you out of it. You know what I'm saying? And so the guy was getting me out of the car, and he's saying I was under arrest for untaxed beer because we live right over there on the Alabama line. And I had Georgia, which is bogus. You know, they don't arrest you for that kind of stuff. But they were going to take me to jail. And so, you know, the dude started grabbing me. Well, I got him off of me, you know, and he's, you know, he didn't like that. So there was two of them there, and they came over there, and they grabbed me, and I got on them kind of, you know, they couldn't get me. And so they call for, you know, here's the thing, you don't ever win against the police, okay? I mean, and they, you know, they hit me with them sticks and stuff like that, the sticks ain't what hurt, okay? They hit me with them sticks, man, I was coming, you know, stick, you know. And they call for backup, and they circled around me, you know, so I got ready. Yeah. I figured I got to take one of them down, you know. So I took one of them down and got him in a headlock. The other ones jumped on my back, and I said, the sticks don't hurt you, but what hurt me was when he reached up under there with that little can of pepper spray, sprayed it in my face. And that's when I started crying like a baby. And I guess I passed out, because the next thing I remember, they were holding me handcuffed and dragging me through the halls of the jail. And, but I knew the judge, you know. And, I got out of that. That's another point, too. People took care of my situations all my life. I never had to do anything, take responsibility for my own actions. My dad would always bail me out. They bailed me out in college, the coaches, you know, everything I did, people, I don't know why, I didn't ask them to. I didn't say, hey, help me here, man, you know. They just did it. And that, you know, I didn't learn from that. You know, I was... only today do I know the great feeling of how it is to do things on your own and have earned things on your own. And but anyway, I went to a guy's wedding and got so drunk I knocked all the tables down, and you know, I did some embarrassing thing. I threw a man through a window in a bar down in Vidalia, Georgia. And, you know, some people got hurt and cut me up. You know, the police came to my hotel where I was already drinking the next morning before the wedding and arrested me, and I spent the day in jail down there. Did the same thing down in Florida, you know. Everywhere I went and drank, man, they took me to jail, you know. I mean, it's the truth, you know. Once I put the chemical in my body, it started a reaction that was not going to end until I was either dead, passed out, you know, hadn't had no money. Well, really dead and passed out for me are the two things, because I would, excuse me, I would keep going. But, you know, the whole time that my dad keeps saying, you know, I'm not going to, you know, fund this and fund that, and I'm not going to, but, you know, he continued to give me a little money here and a little money there, and I got another DUI. I knew the judge, and they let me off, and it wasn't on my record. And, you know, but, you know, here's the thing. Well, let me go here first. I went over to the projects one night. I knew, you know, where town I was from, I knew everybody, you know. And, you know, I was looking for some cocaine one day. One evening, didn't have anything to do, and I was going to buy me some. And I went over there and sent the guy out, and he came back, and he said, I noticed he had a little napkin, you know. I knew something was wrong right then. He opened it up, and it was some little rocks in there. And I'd seen a guy do it before, but I'd never done it myself. I said, this ain't what I want. He said, well, that's all we got around here. And I said, well, all right. So I took it home. Fixed me a little pipe up and started hitting it. I was back over about 10 times that night. What's the counselor's name here that works with, who was our counselor?
Richard.
We worked with Richard. Got glasses.
Oh, Chip.
Chip? Yeah, anybody know Chip? That man went through hell trying to get me to admit I was a drug addict. I wouldn't admit it. And, you know, I wasn't that weak. And, I could accept an alcoholic, but not a drug addict, you know. And I don't know what the thinking was on that, but anyway, so that didn't take long to get a hold of me. The crack cocaine didn't, and I came to Ridgeview, and I think the. You know, I went through. I didn't want to come. You know, I was. You know, I came though, and I did all right. You know, and left, stayed sober a couple months. Didn't go to no meetings, and so I came back the second time here. And by this time, that's the third treatment center I've been to. And that's when I met Sean here. And of course, I had between, I guess, in about a 2-year period. When I'd started using the crack, I'd probably spent a couple $100,000 on it. You know, I had stocks in an account, and I'd learned a lot from my dad over the years, and I would buy and trade, and, you know, he'd send me a $10,000 check, and that thing'd be gone in a week, you know. And and I wasn't sharing it. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't going around to the crack house or whatever, sitting around with a bunch of folks. I was doing it by myself at the house. And I lived in a nice little neighborhood, had my own house, you know, that my dad bought. And, you know, I had neighbors and stuff, nice neighbors. And I was on it. And I started hallucinating. You know, because I'd do $1,000 worth of crack one night by myself, not sharing it now, you know, just by myself. And I started hallucinating. Well, let me tell you something, buddy. That's when all the fan, ceiling, whatever you call it, how you say that? Ceiling hit the fan or something like that? How do you say that?
Shit hit the fan.
The shit hit the fan, huh? I wasn't a leader academically. So, you know, I'm taking the fire detectors off my ceiling and stuff, looking for bugs, and I'm hearing folks in my basement. you know, I'm seeing folks in the trees outside. And I was starting, and listen, I was already a scary person anyway. I ain't never, you know, I was always the kind of person that if I was ever sleeping on my own, you know, I always kind of fall asleep one eye open, you know, because I guess, I don't know, I was just always scared of monsters and stuff. You know, I just always have been. Slept with a hammer under my pillow. You know, I never owned a handgun. I just slept with a hammer. I said, they come in here, you know, I'm going to bust them. So anyway, you know, I'm freaking out. So I know all the cops, you know, in the town there, you know, small town. Shoot, man, I'm calling them over there looking for, you know, looking for. And I'd gone outside and looked at these and never seen these wires on my house before. And there was like some fresh shavings down there. Looked like somebody had, you know, set up some stuff. You know, surveillance. A couple of the cops actually brought me some of the stuff, but one of them that was concerned with me told me, well, they probably are watching you. You know, I had one of those black Lexus SUVs, you know, the one looks like a Land Cruiser. And, you know, I'd be driving over into the, you know, part of town where I was buying drugs. And, you know, he said, you know, the man probably sees you driving over there and come, they probably think you the man, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So that just added to it worse, you know. So, but I'm having them over there. I mean, they're coming through my house. I'm high on crack, drinking, everything else. I'm like, looking here. You know, they going through my house. I got them outside looking at the wires. And they know I'm high, but they don't ever say nothing about it, you know. And they everybody just leaves me alone, you know. And the funny thing, I'd be getting high during the day and everything, you know. I didn't, at this point, I didn't even have a job, you know. My dad and them bring me groceries and stuff like that. They were just putting fuel on it, you know. They didn't want to, but they loved me, you know, and they didn't. So I saw this man out in my tree one afternoon, and he had that, you ever seen that real tree camouflage? It looks just like the tree, and he had that on. He was up against the tree like this, hugging that tree. And I saw him now, okay, I saw him. And I said, I got your ass. I got me a baseball bat and a butcher knife. And I opened my front door, and I don't want to say what I said, but in some foul words, I said, I got you. I'm tired of this. Y'all either going to arrest me, or I said, leave me alone. And I was walking straight to that tree. When I got up to it, he disappeared. And you know what? It was so real. I mean, I was telling my parents that they were after me. And they knew I was crazy. But to me, it was the realest thing I'd ever seen. And, you know, when I stood there and that man disappeared, and I looked over, and there's a lady getting her groceries out of the trunk of a car, and she's standing there like that, looking at me. And I was like, oh, shit. I turned around, went back inside. And this is after I, you know, left Ridgeview. And then I called, finally gotten, she was getting Dr. Fishman to call me. And, you know, this is went on for about, I don't know, 4 to 5 months after I'd left Ridgeview that second time. They sent me out to I agreed to go out to a place in Mississippi called Copac. Some of you probably heard of it. I didn't like it. I didn't like folks, you know, and I'm getting better now, okay? I'm better today, but I didn't like folks challenging me. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if they challenged me, And I was all right with it. Well, that was all right. But if I didn't like it, I didn't want them to push it. And I tried to be as honest as I could. And at this point, I was engaged to be married. I prayed to God. Now, be careful what you pray for. I prayed for years. I prayed to God to send me a woman that was a godly woman and somebody that he would want me to be with. Well, he did. And she was a girl that had never drank in her life, was very committed to her church and her, her spirituality. And she had two small kids and was divorced. And she stuck with me through it and almost left me because she just didn't think it was going to work, you know. And she didn't need that for her two little kids. And, you know, I wasn't about, at this point, I was staying at home. You know, I wasn't even going out. I couldn't go out. I just stayed at home because if I went out, they were going to take me to jail. You know, I couldn't drive or nothing. And I was just, you know, like I said, smoking $1,000 a day of crack, sitting up in the house. And, you know, I'd get cleaned up and go out and run a couple errands or something, but didn't go back home. And that's a miserable thing. That is just a miserable thing. I wasn't that kind of person. I don't think most of us are that kind of people. We're better than that. It happened to me, and I don't blame God at all. As a matter of fact, I thank God for putting me through that situation and letting me go through those things, because you know what? It changed my life. It changed my life. It my relationship with God is much stronger today. You know, I'm sober. I have I started my own business about 3 years ago. It's doing really well. I'm in process, right in the middle of building a house. I've had two beautiful children since we got married, two little girls. I have four kids now. I'm happy, joyous, and free. You know, I got some problems. You know, I'm not normal. I'm not. My wife gives me a hard time because this is the way I dress right here. You know, that's the way I dress. I cut these things off at the bottom and she hemmed them up. Because she didn't want it to look like that. And but I went to that co-pack and I left there after about 70-something days because they started trying to mess with me. And I've been sober ever since. That was 4 years ago. But, you know, and you know what? Although that seems like yesterday, so much has happened in the last 4 years, it seems like. It's almost as if I was never that person. You know, I just wasn't. That wasn't me. I'm who I'm supposed to be today. Or at least I'm working on it. And, but anyway, I left there, AMA, is that what they call it? And they tried to talk me out of it, and I didn't. I went home. But here was the thing. Dr. Fishman, my lower power, said that, I told him, I said, man, I ain't going to all these AA meetings. I ain't got nothing in common with them. I said, hey, they're good people. I ain't got nothing against them, but that ain't me. You know? I mean, I need my relationship to be strong between me and God, and that's how I'm on, you know. And people say they don't find it in the church. Well, you may not. It ain't the church. You know, this is a God program. You know, I think today a lot of folks getting out of that, but, you know, this is a program built on God principles. And my relationship with the God of my understanding. It doesn't have to be the God of your understanding, just the God of my understanding. And I told Dr. Fishman, he said, well, how many you think you'll, he said, they want me to do the 90 and 90. I said, I ain't going to 90 meeting. I told him straight up. I said, you forget that. He said, well, how many you think you'll go to? I said, about 20. I said, I may go to about 20. He thought that was funny, you know. But, and that was before, of course, my... here's the thing, and I guess I'm speaking to any people here that are in treatment. This is a tough time to be in treatment. And, you know, you hear a lot of people get up here and say, if I can do it, anybody can do it. You hear people say that, and I used to hear that, and I used to think that. Yeah, everybody's situation is different, but they're telling the truth. Because if I can do it, anybody can do it. And there's a beautiful world out there, and there's a lot of bad things in it, but there's a great life out there waiting on us. All we got to do is go out there and get it. But it ain't easy. It ain't easy. I wanted to go to treatment and come out and everything be okay. I didn't want to go to meetings, you know. I didn't want to go to no AA meeting. The bottom line is that when I got sober and went to that place in Mississippi, I had had enough. I guess I'd hit my bottom, and I thought I'd hit my bottom before. The difference was is that there were some tools and things offered to me that I had needed to be willing to do in order to try to make this thing work. And I don't think I was willing to do all those things before. And it was just the last time that I went into treatment, came out this time, that, man, you know what? I was willing to do anything. I knew when I left that treatment center, before I was supposed to, that I was going to stay sober. Because I knew I was at the point in my life where I was going to do anything. I was going to stay sober. And I think it's just, you know, I can't explain it. I'm not one of these doctors or, you know, but it's just being willing, I think, you know. And how willing are you to pay the price to get what we have, you know? I wanted to be like the sober people. But I was too afraid I was going to lose too much by getting there or being there. I didn't want to, I don't have a desire to drink today or use drugs. It, you know, by the grace of God, He's taken that away. But don't think for a minute that if Patrick takes his own will back in his life and starts doing things on his own and doesn't include God, and start, you know, bringing back that old attitude, shoot, I'll be back out there drinking again, and I'll lose my wife and kids and everything I have. I ain't no further away from it than anybody that's in this treatment center. I have to stay focused on it one day at a time. And I, you know what? I go to AA meetings, and I love them. I go to them because they're my friends, and these people care about me. Your drinking buddies don't give a damn about you. You know, I mean, once you stop drinking, they're gone. And hey, you know what? That's fine with me. Let them go. You know, when I got sober, I changed my, I don't go to places that serve alcohol. And I go to an Applebee's or something like that and eat dinner, but I would never set foot in a bar. If I did, it's because I went there to drink. But I don't go to any places that are going to bother me. I'm not comfortable around people that are drinking. I don't want to be around them. They're not like me. You know? It's a change, you know, and everybody here knows that happens to us. I'm more accepting of people today, you know. I'm more open-minded. I'm more, I can handle situations with my wife that I couldn't handle before. You know, I can talk to people, communicate with people differently. It's all because of the program Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding. I know for a fact, without any signed piece of paper or proof from any other person that lives in this world, that God, the God that I worship, is real. And he loves me. And when I include him in my life on a daily basis, he lets good things happen to me. And he's real. He is. Thank y'all for letting me be here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing that blessing with us.